This is the son of PCJ.
This is London. This is London.
The Voice of Russia World Service.
This is the Voice of America, Washington, D.C., signing on.
This is the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland, with a relay transmission via Bonaire in the Netherlands Antilles, directed to New Zealand.
This is Radio Prague, Czechoslovakia.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
Bonjour à vous si vous nous rejoignez sur Radio France Internationale. Il est 5h à Paris.
This is Radio Ukraine International.
This is the English program of Radio Deutsche Welle, Germany's international broadcasting service.
Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Paulette Macquarie and Keith Perrell.
Well, hello everyone, and thank you for joining us once again. Today on the program, we head to Rwanda to find out how radio is playing an important role to help people deal with the genocide that took place in the country in 1994, where some 800,000 people were killed. Also, Ken Ritz, the author of a new book called How to Listen to the World, will be joining us, so stay tuned. Media Network Plus, let's build a dipole using the Christmas tree. First, here's Paulette with a look at some of the headlines from the world of media.
A new television news channel in Malaysia, Worldview Broadcasting Channel, expected to launch officially in April next year, has been airing test transmissions in the Klang Valley since December 1st. The test transmission from 7 to 10 p.m. can be viewed by tuning to UHF Channel 39, with magazine programs as well as local and foreign documentaries on air. A statement from the station said that its core content would be news with 70% international news coverage. The rest will comprise a range of current affairs programs and documentaries. WBC local viewers will be able to watch live news reports from various locations around the world, presented from a Malaysian perspective in three languages, Bahasa Malaysia, English, and Arabic, it said. The statement also said that WBC's approach to vary its news sources via cooperation with selected news and current affairs television stations worldwide will offer viewers a fresh experience in news watching. Parts of Australia Network and Radio Australia will be merged along the lines of the BBC, said Australian Broadcasting Corporation Managing Director Mark Scott, a day after control and funding of the overseas television service was handed over permanently to the public broadcaster. Mr. Scott said the ABC was no longer compelled to separate Australia Network and Radio Australia after the Cabinet decision on Monday to hand the 10-year contract worth $223 million to the ABC. We've been offering Radio Australia for 70 years, and what this decision now allows us to do is to bring these two very closely together to basically create a seamless international broadcasting arm for Australia in much the same way that the BBC does it for the UK, said Mr. Scott in an interview on ABC News 24. We'll have that interview coming up on today's program. Websites which exposed violations in Russia's parliamentary polls became inaccessible in a hacking attack their operators said was aimed at preventing them revealing the extent of Election Day fraud. Popular Russian radio station Moscow Echo and election monitoring group Golos said their websites were the victims of massive cyber attacks, while several opposition news sites were inaccessible. The attack on the website on Election Day is clearly an attempt to inhibit publication of information about violations, wrote Moscow editor-in-chief Alexei Venediktov on Twitter. Russia has seen an upsurge in internet penetration since the last elections in 2007, and analysts have said the explosion of critical material on the web poses one of the biggest challenges to United Russia's grip on power. The website of opposition weekly New Times, known to publish investigative reports about government officials and feature columns by jailed oil tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky, was also down, along with news website Slon.ru, which reported a denial-of-service attack. Both have extensively covered the elections campaign and published opinion pieces on voting tactics in what opposition commentators have called a sham election with predetermined results. Russian bloggers also complained of their inability to access their accounts on the popular blogging platform LiveJournal.com. The site has been a victim of repeated denial-of-service attacks throughout the week and has been working intermittently. The goal of the attackers is clear, said Anton Nosek, the media director of LiveJournal owner SUP, on his blog, adding that the perpetrators are a group of criminals who are probably fattened by the federal budget. Some have claimed it's a Soviet-style signal jam and its goal is the same as before, to stop the uncontrolled exchange of information. People across the Middle East region have increasingly turned to the BBC Arabic service during the Arab uprising, with a record rise in audiences, according to independent research recently published. Overall audiences to the BBC's Arabic services have risen by more than 50% to a record high of 33.4 million adults weekly, up from 21.6 million before the Arab Spring. The weekly audience estimates are based on an independent study carried out by the IARP, the International Audience Research Program of the BBC's Broadcasting Board of Governors. BBC Arabic TV's audience has risen by more than 80%, from 13.5 million to 24.4 million. The IARP survey covered Egypt, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Lebanon, and Morocco. The weekly reach across these countries has nearly doubled, from 9.8% to 18.4%. The biggest increases were seen in Egypt, where the BBC Arabic TV audience quadrupled to a weekly reach of 16.2%, reaching 9.3 million people. In turbulent times, the BBC's aim to provide trusted news and impartial information is more valued than ever across the Middle East and North Africa, said Lillian Lander, controller of languages at BBC Global News. These impressive figures show that international audiences are increasingly turning to the BBC for independent news that they can trust, she remarked. In an increasingly competitive TV market, it demonstrates that there will always be space for high-quality journalism that seeks to inform all, even-handedly, she added. Special thanks to Andy Sennett at the Radio Netherlands Worldwide Media Network blog for the material used here today. For more reports from Andy, check out his blog, http://blogs.rnw.nl/media network. You can also find the link at our website, www.pcjmedia.com.
And you're listening to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio. Radio has had a dark history in Rwanda. The station, Radio Merkelin, helped incite the 1994 genocide that killed some 800,000 people. But radio remains Rwanda's most popular medium. One station, Contact FM, is trying to bring modern radio to the Rwandan airwaves and is pushing some of the boundaries the government has put in place. We have this special report from Mary Kay Magston from The World, a program jointly produced by the BBC, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston.
Albert Rudat Simbura starts his day in the radio station he founded, walking past posters of Bob Marley, Che Guevara, and Jimi Hendrix. Rudat Simbura launched the station in the last days of 2004 with an old friend, who happens to be the brother-in-law of President Paul Kagame. The first thing on the air was a recording of Miles Davis playing So What from Kind of Blue. Rudat Simbura is a musician himself. He's also a returnee, having grown up in Belgium. When he settled in post-genocide Rwanda, he says, he realized something was missing from the radio scene.
Before we started, it was only the state radio. So that was the model. So we wanted just to show what it should be, you know, having funny breakfast shows, nice news. You must have noticed a kind of a post-genocide trauma, self-censorship culture. So we try to tell people that things could be different.
The station now has about 2 million listeners, a fifth of Rwanda's population. It offers music, call-in shows, debate, and news, and has about a dozen young reporters.
Bonjour. Morning.
They gather daily for an editorial meeting.
This is Contact FM newsroom.
On this morning, one story in the works is about an illegal government detention center for street kids and vagrants.
Who decides when you can walk out? Ariko, based on what? When do they decide?
The reporter on the story is 25-year-old Richard Enda Yambaje. I ask what happens if he writes something the government doesn't like.
You never know what happens to you, but all you have to do as a journalist, I think, is to report the truth and, you know, wait to see what happens, whether the story makes an impact.
He says things are already better than when he started out in journalism 4 years ago. There are now dozens of Rwandan news media outlets, and the government is considering passing freedom of information legislation. Even so, critics of the government say press freedom in Rwanda remains seriously limited. Karina Tersakian is a senior researcher for Human Rights Watch. She was kicked out of Rwanda last year and now lives in London.
Everyone now knows the very negative role that the media played in the run-up to the genocide, and I think any responsible government would take measures to avoid that. But unfortunately, what has been happening instead is that this very vaguely defined offense of genocide ideology has been used to target government critics, not only journalists, but also opposition politicians and even ordinary Rwandans.
According to a Rwandan Senate report, about 200 people were convicted on the charge of genocide ideology from 2001 to 2006. Some were sentenced to years in prison. Rights groups have expressed concern about how many journalists have been convicted on this charge. Shaika Kanuma, editor of the newspaper Rwanda Focus, says such rights groups should take a closer look at what some of the convicted journalists have been writing.
You'll find someone writing that Hutus, actually it's their time to rise up. We are talking just 17 years after the genocide. And they'll go out and be publishing stuff that includes incitement.
President Paul Kagame makes no apologies for restricting speech he believes could reopen old wounds. At a recent news conference, he didn't try to hide his disdain for human rights groups that criticize his government.
We live in this world where some people think they're more right or even righteous than others.
Kagame's supporters say he has helped bring Rwanda back from the dead, that his government has restored social stability, built up the economy, and encouraged reconciliation, mostly. Others say he rules with too heavy a hand. Some ask why Kagame suspended two newspapers critical of him in the run-up to last year's national elections, why several journalists say they received threats or had been roughed up and had to flee the country. Vocal critic Charles Ingabire fled the country and was living in Uganda when he was shot dead last month, coming out of a bar. Another journalist was killed in Rwanda last year. The government has denied involvement in both cases. Rights groups have called for independent investigations. Karina Tersakian of Human Rights Watch.
The climate for independent journalists in Rwanda right now is pretty bleak.
By independent, she means those who criticize the government. Rwanda Focus editor Shaika Kanuma argues, as rain pours down outside the pavilion we're in, that there is room for criticism, just not for lies.
I know that Paul Kagame is not a perfect president. He's not a perfect person. But when I see the terrible lies people tell, I know the kind of challenges we face as journalists in this country, but does that amount to abuse of human rights? Far from the case.
Back at Contact FM, owner Albert Rudatsimbura says journalism still has a long way to go in Rwanda, but he and his staff are trying. The station now has a weekend talk show called Crossfire. He says the show's free exchange of ideas can get pretty heated. I ask if there's also room in Rwanda for political satire, something like The Daily Show.
I think that it will take some time. You need the material to brew political satire. I mean, you need to see what politicians are doing. And most of the time, that is not public enough.
He says there's a funny YouTube video of a Rwandan comedian imitating President Kagame.
Same voice, same everything, you know. And I could see that some guys in the room were like, uh-oh, is this correct? Is this PC? You know, and even the president was there. And because he had a big laugh, I mean, everyone started to feel relaxed, you know. But I could see that some guys were stressed.
What Rwandans need, even more than satire, Rudatsumbura says, is to lose their submissive attitude toward power.
For people to understand that in a society like this, people are citizens. And in a society where you have citizens, we're not supposed to be treated as subjects. It's not a king there.
The call-in programs at Contact FM try to encourage people to speak up. And never are there more calls, Rudatsumbura says, than in the week each April when the station opens up the lines to commemorate the genocide. Survivors call in. A couple of perpetrators have called in to apologize.
Another case that we had also, we had a call. A couple of seconds, a guy saying, you know what? What we did in 94, we'll do it again.
The caller was referring to the genocide. His phone number was traced and he was arrested. Rudatsumbura says more young people are calling in these days and talking about the genocide as history. About half of Rwandans are too young to remember it. The government's policy to squelch hate speech and even mentions of ethnic divisions means they've grown up thinking of themselves not as Hutu or Tutsi, but as Rwandan. Whether that's come at too high a cost to free speech is open to debate. But a recent survey by the Prosperity Index in London found that most Rwandans feel they have adequate personal freedoms and trust their government. Less than a third said they trust each other.
That was Mary Kay Magston reporting for The World, a program produced by the BBC, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. And by the way, you're listening to PCJ Radio's Media Network Plus. First, a couple of program notes. For those in Africa and Asia that tune us in on the World Radio Network, beginning December 24th, there is a change to our time. Currently, we're to that region at 11 hours UTC. But beginning December 24th, we will be heard at 16 hours UTC. The next thing, some holiday programming that we have coming up. On December 24th, we're going to be looking at the lighter side of broadcasting with a show of bloopers and, well, some other surprises. And the edition of the program that will be airing on December 31st, we're going to be talking about something very special. Two very special people indeed. You'll have to tune in to find out. If you wish to find out more information about the program or listen to past editions, go to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus. That's www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus. And of course, you can write us at any time. Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. mnp@pcjmedia.com. Now, there have been many books written about international broadcasting. Some people may think that with everything written in the past and all the cuts that have been taking place, is there room for another book? Well, you were wrong. Ken Reitz, who writes for Monitoring Times, has just published a new book called How to Listen to the World. Ken, my first question to you about your new book, which is called How to Listen to the World, is very simple. I mean, we've seen so many cutbacks taking place in shortwave radio around the world. Some stations that were the top 10 stations to listen to, like Radio Sweden, have gone the way of the dodo. Swiss Radio International is gone as well. Why write this book at this time?
Oh, well, there's a lot changing in shortwave radio today, internationally. And it's true that over the last couple of years, cutbacks from previously available international shortwave broadcasters, BBC, and all the rest that you just named, these are all probably never going to come back. But what we're seeing now is a change in who's at the top. As I mentioned in the beginning of the book, there are new voices coming out onto shortwave, and one of them is Radio Nigeria, Voice of Nigeria, and I thought it was kind of interesting that that they were saying that, look, you know, we need to be a presence on the shortwave bands, And so a lot of people are seeing this as well in the developing countries. And, of course, these particular countries are awash in oil revenues, and so they're not scared away by the expense of setting up a brand-new shortwave radio station and beaming regionally or internationally to make their policies heard, which is the whole point of international shortwave broadcasting.
One of the things that I find really interesting, especially in the last 10 years, so many people have been talking about the doom and gloom of shortwave. Its days are numbered. It's going to be long gone. But there are so many regions of the world and so many countries around the world where shortwave is even used for domestic broadcasting. If we take, let's say, China, for example, or Indonesia and many others. And it seems that people are remembering, let's say, the golden era of shortwave, where you can have one station on sometimes 10 frequencies at one time. Of course, things have changed, but there still is, as my dad would say, a lot of life in the old girl.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And if we were just to concentrate on the international shortwave broadcasters, from the listener's point of view, especially from the shortwave hobbyist point of view, we might be disappointed. But when you start including all the other areas of occupation in the high-frequency bands, then it starts to get really interesting, particularly if you monitor the amateur radio bands, which are all over the place, if you monitor the utility stations, if you monitor pirate shortwave broadcasting, if you monitor just about any other kind of thing, digital, voice, there are many modes that are happening out there too. And that presents a challenge to all listeners. But one thing that struck me as you were alluding to the golden age of radio, or shortwave radio, which may have been from the 1960s through to the end of the Cold War, which basically was the whole point of shortwave at that time, is that what we also had was what people used to think of as the golden age of shortwave radios. And those were the big old metal Hallicrafters and Hammerlind and Collins, that sort of gear. And while there's no doubt they were the top of the line at the time, the new shortwave radios that are available today run rings around them in terms of well, for one thing, weight and desk space. You can have a dynamite shortwave radio that takes up virtually no space on your desk. It has a digital frequency readout. It stores hundreds of channels of interest that you can call up in a second. And they're extremely sensitive. These are tremendous radios. And I would put them up against, put many of these up against some of the best of those days. And I maintain that we're currently living in the golden age of the shortwave radio manufacturer. There are plenty of radios out there under $500 that are top grade performers.
Let me ask you, with this book, who are you targeting? Are you targeting people, let's say, that don't know anything about shortwave and may have just come across shortwave doing a Google search and want to know more about it?
Actually, it's actually targeted to all these all groups. I can't tell you how many times I've come across a forum, a shortwave or radio forum, and someone will ask a question and say, I found a shortwave radio at the dime store for $39, and I really want to get into shortwave radio, and is this going to work for me? And I'm thinking, wow, you know, I could really help this guy save $39 by saying, no, don't buy that. If you kick in another $30, $40, you might be able to get K2 1103 or something else, and it'll run rings around that thing. So it is truly for the beginner, but it's also for the seasoned shortwave listener as well, because I not only cover the shortwave bands, as you saw in there, but also how to get your amateur radio license, and covering things such as free-to-air satellite TV and radio, and also the whole idea of internet radio, getting started in internet radio as well. So there are so many things, so many facets of different. This whole business about radio is a glorious diamond that has thousands of facets, and you don't have to be an expert in any one of them to enjoy them. You can sample the fun that they all provide. One of the things I really enjoy doing recently has been monitoring the amateur radio satellites or the International Space Station. And now they've started putting out all these miniature satellites, and some of them are only 5 centimeters on a side. They're actual full-functioning satellites. They have transmitters on board. They have solar panels attached to them, and they're in orbit. They'll be in orbit for years, and they some of them send data. Some of them are checking out. For instance, there's one that just flew in September, Montana State University, and the kids there have put together this satellite to measure radiation in the Van Allen belt as it circulates. So, you know, these aren't just hobby satellites. They're actually getting things done. And anyone on the face of the Earth with a scanner and a handmade Yagi antenna can actually tune these in. So there's between shortwave and satellites, it's just an absolutely fascinating hobby.
How to Listen to the World. If somebody would like to buy the book, Ken, what can they do?
Well, it's one of the best things about Kindle, which is Kindle Publishing, which is done through Amazon, is that these are e-books. They're electronic publications, and you can actually read them on any electronic device. You don't even have to have a Kindle or an iPad or any name brand thing. You can read it on your laptop, and you can read these on your personal computer as well. And if you go to Amazon.com and go to Kindle Books, and you just type in "How to Listen to the World," and it will pop right up. And the other thing that's cool about e-publishing is that you say, "Well, I don't know. I said, gee, $2.99 American. That may be a little steep." So go ahead and open it up, and you can read the first chapter. You'll see the table of contents, which will tell you whether or not there's anything else you want to read in the book. And you get a chance, a flavor of the book, by reading the first chapter. And that's the way they do on all the e-books. It's an opportunity to look at books and judge them, not just by the cover, but by a little bit of the content. And if you like it, then you click to buy it. And if you don't like it, you give it a pass.
Ken, thank you very much for taking some time out to talk to us today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Keith.
And I was speaking there with Ken Ritt. If you want more information about his book, How to Listen to the World, just go to Amazon.com and type in How to Listen to the World. It's a fascinating read. Anyway, guess what? We've come to the end of this edition of Media Network Plus. I just want to remind you again that over the next 2 weeks, we have a couple of very special programs that you certainly don't want to miss. And then in January, Dan Hensley will be joining us for his weekly propagation report. So on behalf of Paulette McCrory, Dan Hensley, and myself, Keith Parent, we hope to see you all again very, very soon. 73s to you all, and 88 to the ladies.
The sound and the silk forever.